Hi, I'm Tamlin. I work at Plusnet, an ISP based in Sheffield. So, related question to the previous one. But we're trying to work usability testing into the process, but we're trying to find a way to do that so that doesn't actually hold people up. So I'm often finding that management are in favour of everything that I'm doing. But stuff gets released and I haven't even seen it. Or it gets, I get to see it when it's in beta and it's just about to be released. And of course by then it's far too late to actually do anything. So we want to work usability in at a very early stage and make sure nothing can get released without being reviewed by a designer or a usability expert. But how to do that without actually holding everything up? Because people, developers are going to get upset that they can't make their little fixes without it being reviewed by a usability expert.
But surely it's going to make it even worse if the thing that you launch, you've got to go back to them in 2 weeks' time and say, well, actually, we screwed up here, and you've got to redo it all again because it's not usable.
Yes, absolutely. Currently, we don't do it all again, and so it just ends up being unusable. But ideally, everything needs to be... I completely agree, everything needs to be tested early on. But do you have any tips on how to work that into the process so it doesn't end up being a bottleneck?
Well, again, it's, you know, if you're outsourcing it to a large agency and you've got to sort of plan this test for 2 weeks in advance and it's going to take ages, if you just do it internally and, you know, grab five users, you know, have a batch of users already waiting and just grab five users and test, it can take a day or two. So, yeah, of course, you know, if you expend effort and that effort takes time, that's going to add on to the overall, you know, the sort of the project timing. But it only needs to be 2 or 3 days. I mean, really, test... next day, roll those tests back into your results. And in fact, I mean, if this is kind of based on working in wireframes, Microsoft have sort of coined a term of right methodology. It was rapid interactive testing and evaluation, which they use for a lot of game design. And what they do is they actually test and then make the changes then and there. So they have one user in, they'll test it. As soon as they find a problem, they get the developers to implement the changes immediately. And then once those changes are implemented, they get a next test subject into test, and again and again and again. And what you get is, at the end of the process, you get a working thing. It's not like a big series of recommendations that you've then got to give to your developers. Your developers are actively involved in the process of making these changes. But that works much better on a live project than it does on say, wireframes. But write methodology, do a quick search, and it's a very interesting process.
Have you ever tried working in an agile project to do design?
Yeah, we have actually, and it went really well, and then Everyone forgot about it, and Back to the old way of doing things.
Does anyone else work in agile software development methodologies? Right, we've got some war stories over there, probably. it's a very much more condensed form of what you just said, in that the basic tenet of agile, or one of the basic tenets, is that, you know, you're going to start what they call a sprint, and then finish that a fixed period of time later, and within that, you've got a very fixed number of things to do that you've all committed as a team to do. And trying to do design in that process in the early days for us was an absolute impossibility, because the moment you want to stop and test something, developers saying, well, we need to finish it in 3 weeks or 2 weeks, whatever the length of the sprint was. And the way around that, and actually tie exactly into what was said down there, is about collaborative design and including the development team in the design process and making that something that you do together. So because it's not a waterfall design where somebody's responsible for design, it drops into development, and the design is done very iteratively and very collaboratively, that kind of works. And so collaborative design, I think, is the way to do that. And sometimes, actually, the best ideas come from developers or someone who's much more technically minded that sometimes a designer or an experienced professional just wouldn't have seen. So there are other benefits to it as well.
So over there we had somebody putting up their hands and saying, yes, I've done this. And I wondered, you know, was sort of, first of all, have you, in the agile process, have you included a sort of user-centered design element of it? Lady in green there with the long hair. Was there a user-centered design element to the agile process?
Behind you. Next to Javier.
Oh, yeah.
Javier, put your hand there.
No, I think the intention was there, but we never really carried it.
It just never happened. Why didn't it happen?
Not really. Time.
Yeah. So, you know, once again, it's like, oh, we're busy developing. Yeah. Anybody else managed to do it successfully?
Also, sometimes the challenge is to work with a team, so to put everybody working with the same goal, you know, business, marketing, technical designers, IAs. That is a challenge that doesn't go harmoniously very often.
One thing that we've found is designers didn't feel comfortable giving criticism or ideas to developers. Developers didn't feel comfortable giving designers ideas. And business side of things didn't always want to communicate anyway. And one of the challenges we had to do was actually just give everybody permission to talk and to be able to be critical of each other's work. And that got a lot of the discussion happening earlier on in the process, so we could start to actually look at, you know, focusing on the user's needs instead of what the developers needed or the database needed. And we've had a few issues at FP where, you know, some people start working and all of a sudden we have database-driven design, which is a really horrible thing. So just get everybody talking and give people permission.
I mean, we're talking about, you know, sort of my experience of running teams like that is that if you start off with nothing and you're testing and looking at other people's work, there's nothing there to criticize, and it becomes much easier for people to start a conversation about what's working, why is it working, when we build this thing that we're going to build shortly, what could we learn from what we've seen so far? So, you know, starting off with the past, the thing that you know you're going to throw away, is a way of letting people enter the conversation without feeling that they're being criticized.
Yeah, precisely. If you can, you know, in your early stages, if you're working on paper prototypes and even just sketches on a whiteboard, the more ideas you can get out there together as a team with the designers and developers and just throw them away, and then the designers can go off and take everything they've learned, start to formulate a design. But you also have an amazing thing starts to happen is you'll have developers start coming into the designer's room to see how things are going and provide little, you know, ideas and details to make it better down the road. And it kind of gets everybody focused on the overall goal.
I've basically had quite a bit of experience with Agile, but the golden question is, when do you move from documentation of Visio and Photoshop, and when do you hand over to developers, and when do you stop updating documentation to match the interactive product?
Yeah.
And when do you also integrate UX into the scrums, which are the daily scrums, because we have UX scrums and we have technical scrums
really?
As separate. And
does everybody here know what a scrum is? Everybody scrum. Happy with that?
Well, so scrum is an agile methodology. One of the all agile methodologies broadly form around the same kind of manifesto. agilemanifesto.org, isn't it? Agilealliance.org, if you want to look it up. And it's a daily stand-up meeting that lasts no more than 15 minutes. And you basically go around the circle and say, this is what I did yesterday, this is what I'm going to do today, and this is what's holding me up. And it's a very efficient way to do things. The interesting thing we've found is that we don't split those scrums. How many people are in the scrum, by the way?
In the technical scrum, I think there are about six. In the UX, there's about five. But
okay.
Some of the UX, some of the front-end developers get involved with the UX because we see that as user experience.
Okay. We have one scrum per team, and some of the teams can be up to 30 people in size. So you can imagine 30 people step around at 9 o'clock in the morning. Which is quite interesting.
What did you do yesterday? I was in the scrum.
Yeah.
What are you going to do tomorrow?
Exactly. I'll be in another scrum. No, the point is they only last 15 minutes, so you're time limited. So what then tends to happen is the barriers that get thrown up by individuals then get spun off into separate things to try and solve those. And early on, we found that actually the user experience professionals, whether they're designers, IAs, or whatever in the team, were too much of a bottleneck because basically everybody in the scrum wanted them for something. I need to work on the interaction design of this, the IA of that, and they were just too much in demand. And we used to get caught in wireframe hell, as we used to call it, where you'd have the wireframe bible, which was you spend so much time updating the bloody wireframes based on what you did that day that you would never actually do any design. So we broke that a couple of years ago. And the things that are important in Agile are, I'll say two things, there's probably three, but anyway. The first one is to set a vision very early on. So Agile has this concept of customer activities, and the customer, i.e. the business product owner, is expected to arrive at a project having a fairly firm understanding of what they want to do, why they want to do it, what the benefits are going to be, and broadly what the scope of it is. Most customers don't, though. So when you get into sprint zero in Scrum terms, you're trying to have to sort all that out, and it's too much. So the first thing we do is say, take some of those activities up front and try and create something that is more of a vision about where they potentially want to be, not at the end of the project, but maybe in 2 to 3 years' time. Because nobody can argue with that. Yeah. Part of the challenge of Scrum is that, or Agile generally, is that there's very little room to innovate, because the moment you do something that's not normal or a bit tricky, then the first thing the developer says, well, I won't be able to get that finished this sprint. So it gets kicked off, or it gets done in a more basic format. So if everybody starts the project with an understanding of this is where we want to get to in 3 years' time, and there's some really cool things in there, the whole team has a chance to kind of buy into the bits that they want to work on. And then they're much more enthusiastic about taking them and actually doing them and getting them done, because you're not overcommitting them. Early on, the designers generally had a challenge, which was technology guys would say, you've sold us down the river, you've given us an impossible thing to do, and you've sold it to the client already, and now we're lumbered with doing it, and it's going to take 4 sprints. And of course, it then gets kicked out. So the vision bit up front helps an awful lot with that. So then the practical question you asked about, you know, when do you switch from wireframes? Again, the basic principle of Agile is it's just enough communication and it's just enough everything, yeah? So if the moment a wireframe is ceasing to be useful, you ditch it and you move on to something else. And particularly when you get into interaction design, there's more to be communicated in a 5 to 10 minute conversation with a developer than there ever is in a wireframe. So it's about starting to shift the communication to those points. And then starting to work more on the designed pages or the pages that are growing out the Agile applications. As something is complete, don't do a wireframe that reflects that. Just take a screenshot of that complete screen and start annotating that, or just talking to the developer directly about it. And then over time you get this kind of wedge effect of you gradually drop more and more wireframes as the site becomes more and more templated over time. And you move much more to face-to-face or kind of scribbled kind of communication. So the other useful book to read is Dan Rome, The Back of the Napkin, or whatever it's bloody called, where he puts much more emphasis on the value of things like quick sketches to communicate an idea. They're much more effective than spending 20 minutes, 30 minutes doing a wireframe Visio. Yeah.
So because we are actually going externally to do some user testing and accessibility testing, and I have proposed that we take screenshots of the working product and annotate them as a brief for the usability company, because at the moment, I think, yeah, you're right. I mean, updating the wireframes is a hell job. Mm. And considering there's also another designer working on Photoshop files, which is representing the same thing, but changing as well at the same time, it's a thankless task. So
you need to get that tight circle of a UX, a designer, and a UI developer working very collaboratively. So over time, eventually the UI developer turns around to the UX and says, what should we do here? So change that. Designer says, okay, I'll give you the little bit of the graphic to slot into the page, and it's done kind of live. The other question for you, when do you do your usability testing?
We're doing it 2-3 weeks before beta.
Okay.
But it's a secret beta.
Okay. And do you do it at the end of a sprint?
No. I mean, I would have liked to have a few people in the company review the product before, but it's...
We've rolled a pattern where we'll... at the end of every short period of development called the sprint, there's what they call a sprint review, which is reviewing the product with the business, the people who commissioned it. And we find it useful to actually do it at the same time the sprint review is going on, run usability testing at the same time. Now, there's no chance then to feed back into the next sprint, but you get an opportunity to feed into the sprint afterwards. And all those items that fall out of that usability test, while the team's essentially dormant doing nothing, you're free to go and do that testing. And that's quite a nice pattern. And it works when you've got 4 or 5 or more sprints. It doesn't work when there's shorter sprints than that, so you kind of think about something different. I'll stop talking.
Cool. Yes, please. We've got a question outside of... I know, you know, we've spoken a bit about Agile, but I wonder if we've got a question outside of that. Is that...
Luke Rozell from iTogether. The things we build are on the social web, and so we have up to tens of thousands of users sometimes kind of coming at us proactively and saying, you know, what you've done is great, or what you've done really sucks, and what about doing this? And they're coming through all these different channels like Facebook and... Well, have comments on our blog and email and, you know, sometimes on the phone. So does the panel have any thoughts on how the kind of social embeddedness of certain types of application can actually feed into the user experience testing process?
Udi, I mean, that sounds... eBay's an enormous community of buyers and sellers. You know, does that community directly influence the design process?
The answer is yes and no. In the case of eBay, which is a very specific case, it's quite tricky because most of the companies or most of the services represent one side. You're either the buyer or the seller, or either trying to sell something or trying to do something for with the community. eBay at any given point needs to be good for the seller, good for the buyer, good for the company itself. Obviously, you can't lose profits. So if you get a lot of ideas coming from sellers, you might look at them one by one and say they're great for sellers, but buyers won't want them, and the other way around. So it's very tricky. We do listen very carefully to what happens in the community areas and the forums and everything that's being, every change that's being launched. You'll have people watching every word happening on the forum to see how do people react to that. And there's a science of learning how to listen to that as well, because in a lot of cases you have a big peak of people doing like crazy, liking it or don't liking it, but then you can't listen on the first day only. You need to give it a bit of while and see what happens then. So some reactions maintain, and then you realize maybe we've done something wrong or we've done something really right. But you need to be patient with it. However, when something comes up which looks like a good combination between sellers, buyers, and the company, we would do our best to make it happen.
And people love giving you feedback, even if they don't have any feedback to give you. You know, you learn this from sort of doing usability testing. What people say they want and what people actually want and how they behave are two very, very different things. You can sit down and watch someone behave in a certain way. You can see them get really, really frustrated with a product. And then when you ask them at the end, what do you think? They say, this was great. This is the best thing ever. So I think it's really, really important to, you know, it is important to take feedback from the community, but you've also got to take it with a huge pinch of salt. The kind of people that are going to be very outspoken and offer suggestions are often, you know, they will drown out the vast majority of people that don't want change or are perfectly happy with what's going on in your site. So again, you need to use all the tools at your service. You need to use usability testing, you need to use surveys, you need to use focus groups, you need to listen to opinion and feedback. And I think it's very, very dangerous just to, and we have this a lot because we, as a client, as a company, we do a lot of social software websites, and it's really compelling when somebody emails a client and says, oh, I think you should use this feature, or you should add this because it make it really, really useful. But the amount of features that users suggest, and when you implement them, they never use, is amazing. So yeah, be very, very careful and listening to what people say. So watch what they do instead.
Sorry, that's where you can support that with. So the question is how you prioritise. Yeah. So how, and you know, Udi's got part of that, which is about okay, where's the kind of sweet spot between all those people's mutual benefit, and where there's mutual benefit, that's obviously the right thing to do. The question is how you measure the mutual benefit and the likelihood of someone to adopt that, which is, you know, where it's coming from there. A user-centered approach would mean you would have a very clear idea of who your target was in terms of a user persona, and you can use the personas to validate that. So any suggestion that comes in, you say, you know, so there's our persona, Joe Brown, who does this, and we know him very well because we made him up years ago and he's been very useful in our design processes. How would he react to that? You know, how would she react to this? And yes, I could see them using that. Okay, well, maybe we'll run with that. And that's part of that prioritization process, and that's what personas are for, essentially.
Is anybody here trying to run a user test on a social network? Anybody encounter any particular problems? I mean, I'd have thought, okay, well, I'd have thought one of the things, you know, that strikes me immediately is a normal user test. You've got a person and a computer, and it's about, you know, the dialogue between those two. With an online community, you've actually got two people who have some sort of relationship, and the community just sort of mediates that. So how do you plan a test where, you know, you've got to recruit two people who have some kind of relationship? I mean, can you do that? Is that possible? Is it possible to run a realistic user test on an online community where it might be one or many people talking to each other?
In my experiences, people usability sort of test subjects. are very, very capable of suspending disbelief. Much in the same way as when I sit in a cinema and watch Star Wars, I know these planes aren't, or these TIE fighters aren't really flying. I just suspend the disbelief. Sorry to ruin the magic there of cinema. But, you know, and so my experience is that people are very, very up for play acting and role playing. You don't have to physically have.
Are they really users though when they're just play acting?
Again, this goes down to the whole sort of the deep scientific validity of this kind of stuff. If you want to get absolute certainty that this behaviour is natural and real, then yes, you need to go down that level. But the kind of level that I want to get quick design insights. And there, you know, people play act and people are very, very willing to suspend disbelief.
Can I come back in on that? Hi. Because we did actually... Is this on? Yeah. We did actually run a user experience test of our new service, BuzzSpotter. And initially we started off with quite a traditional methodology of taking single users and showing them service and asking them their impressions and to compare with other services. And it really didn't work in the sense that they didn't really get it. And then the other people in the room, it was a messaging service, they started using it and the messages started coming in on the screen. So that's what it's for. We needed that live environment in that case because it was a very timely and social service. I don't think you could have experienced it without actually being embedded in it in that case.
You're lucky as well that you had a real-time service. I mean, if it had been the sort of thing where people were expected to communicate with a time lag between them, would you ever have got to that insight?
Possibly not, yeah.
I mean, there are obviously specific services where you need to... agents, you know, if you're testing an IM client, it's no fun testing it if there's only one person having a conversation. So you do need people, or you do need, you know, the wireframe set up to fake that kind of interactivity. But you can do that with JavaScript and with careful planning and with clicking on links and moving to separate pages. It is possible. You're never going to get 100%, you know, natural behavior testing on a prototype. You can get close enough that it gives you some kind of, you know, useful information. The other thing to bear in mind is, you know, as I tried to say earlier on, usability testing is about a few things: about efficiency, it's about effectiveness, it's about, you know, having error-free behavior. It's not testing people's emotional responses necessarily. It's not testing whether people like the application or whether the application is meaningful to them. That is something else. And I see a lot of people planning usability tests where they're not testing usability. They're testing personal preference or interest or desire, this more subjective stuff. And you can't really do that with a usability test. With usability testing, it's great for observational behavior. It's much more difficult to test whether your idea is actually a good one.
That's what beta sites are for.
Just got one little comment to make on this. And it actually goes back to a comment you made. A lot of times when people do usability testing, they'll take a nice finished mock-up and they have a nice Photoshop file and it looks great and everybody says, yep, that's what I want. What I found is show them a sketch. And it could be that you've taken your original designs that are done in Photoshop and you render them like a pencil sketch with marker and stuff, so it looks really rough. And if people know it's a sketch, they're much more willing to actually give you feedback because they feel they can still do it at that point, where if it's finished, it's like it's finished.
I think the interesting thing is we are in a sort of a bit of a brave new world where usability testing comes out of sort of HCI, human-computer interaction. It comes out of a world which is really sort of fairly static, and it's about completing tasks. It's about using Word to write, you know, Word documents, this kind of stuff. And we're now building web applications and social applications that are much more game-like in the interaction. And, you know, rather than sort of looking to how the sort of traditional HCI industry works, I think we now need to start looking at how games companies use sort of usability testing and user experience testing. And you'll see that people, that the Microsoft have got a really interesting user experience team working on their games. And Halo is this massive game that took, I think it was $100 million on the first week of it launching. And it's a game that, you know, you don't have to play. So they've got to make sure that the experience is up to scratch. And they do, you know, they do variants of usability testing that isn't just purely about efficiency and ease of use, but they do things like pop up a box every 3 minutes to ask the test subjects whether they're enjoying the game. This isn't strictly usability, but it's using usability style methodology to gain an insight that is more about people's emotional state. And this is kind of almost what you're hinting at. And so I think we need to learn that there are other things apart from just usability testing that we need to kind of look into.
I mean, that's really interesting. And there's, you know, we've spoken a lot about the one-on-one usability test, whether it's in the guise of a kind of a formal test or a guerrilla test. But it's kept coming back to that as the place for the user insight. But I was talking to somebody the other week, and they work on a very large e-commerce site, and they're currently looking at the next generation of that site. And I thought what was interesting there was that they got two companies in to help them with it. One company, who's looking at just the navigation design, was a, you know, what you might call a traditional user experience company. But the other company that was looking at some of the page design and if you like and layout issues was actually a search engine optimization company, and they were bringing user insights and bringing them from somewhere else. So I wonder, you know, are we looking at a world where, you know, there are new sources of data, new places to find out user insights, and that you know, usability people are going to have to up their game and look around a little harder for some of those insights.
Well, again, this is moving sort of a long way away from usability testing, but companies like Amazon have been doing multivariate testing for a very long time.
Multivariate testing.
It's kind of sort of similar to A/B testing. So, you know, back in the day for you know, direct marketing companies, they would send out two flyers that had slightly different designs, and then they would test the response rates and see which of those two designs was the better design. It elicited more responses. And we can do that now using various technologies. Google Optimizer is one that allows us to do multivariate testing. So we, you know, if we've got a question about whether you know, the button needs to be on the left or on the right, or whether it needs to be red or green or whatever, we can set up multivariate testing using Google Optimizer. And we can tell which of those two options or which of those three or four options is the most effective.
But that isn't... You spoke about user testing not being scientific, but that's incredibly scientific. And there you're talking about the margins of, you know, 0.5% here and there, aren't you?
One of the reasons why usability testing isn't scientific is because you do need larger sample sizes to get the confidence interval that you're after. If you're doing multivariate testing, you can test on, you know, quite often I'll go to Amazon and I'll see in the same office a completely different homepage to the person sat next to me because they're looking at data sets or sample sets of multiple millions. And you can tell whether, you know, if 65% of users prefer one design over the other, then that is ultimately, it might not be the best looking design, but it's ultimately the most effective.
But so there's a classic follow-up to that, which is then you've got to follow that up with an ethnographic piece of research that basically asks the question of why. Because if you're asking two really bad questions, you know, then and people respond better to the least of the bad questions, then they're still not very good questions, or they're not very good answers, if you like. So you've got to then get in underneath those stats and ask the question why, and get the emotional response. So it's exactly what you said, Andy, but it's bringing that back in the end. Oh, I'm seeing the wind-up signal, so I'm going to stop talking again.
I'd like to thank the panel for a really wide-ranging debate, and to thank you guys in the audience for you know, such a interesting, varied set of questions. We've covered everything from, you know, why should we even bother doing usability testing, to the niceties of integrating it into an agile environment, and the different types of methodologies that are out there. This isn't the end of the evening. It's the beginning. The bar is there. You're all primed with ideas, and so all that remains for me to do is to thank the panel and say I'm looking forward to talking to you all individually afterwards. Thank you very much.
Chinwag Live: Real World Usability on April 22nd, 2008 was a Chinwag production. For more information, please visit www.chinwag.com.